The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello, everyone. It's Tom here. Before we get into this week's very special episode of Last Orders with Lord Frost, I just want to let you all know about our fantastic new sponsor, The Monk Debates. The Monk Debates are where leading thinkers tackle the big issues of the day, from whether political correctness is a force for good or ill to if we can trust the mainstream media anymore. And you definitely won't want to miss the next Monk Debate that's coming up on the 17th of June. UK commentator Douglas Murray and international law expert Natasha Horsdorf will debate former MSNBC anchor Mehdi Hassan and Israeli journalist Gideon Levy. If you haven't already guessed, they'll be discussing anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism and whether there's a double standard where Israel is concerned. The debate will be taking place in person in downtown Toronto, but don't worry if you can't make it all the way to Canada. Supporters of the Monk Debates can live stream the event for free. Becoming supporters is the best way to make the most of the Monk Debates for just $9.99 in Canadian dollars or about $5.81 in UK pounds each month. You'll get early access to tickets and priority seating when you can make it in person for events like this. And not only can you live stream new events for no extra cost, but you'll also get access to old events as well. So as a Monk supporter, you can watch and listen to the entire back catalogue over the course of the past 15 years. Plus, for a limited time only, Monk Debates are offering a 10% discount on their supporter membership scheme, just for Last Orders listeners. All you have to do is use the code SPIKED10, that's SPIKED10, at checkout to get 10% off. To find out more, just go to monkdebates.com. That's MUNKdebates.com. And don't forget to use the discount code SPIKED10, that's SPIKED10, when you claim your supporter membership. Thanks so much, and now on with the show.
Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. In this very special episode, we sit down with Lord Frost to discuss the battle for the soul of the Conservative Party, the tyranny of the nanny state, and why freedom must be at the heart of politics. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by my co-host Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
Very well, thanks, Tom. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Sweet.
Also delighted to be joined today by a very special guest, David Frost. David, known to many of our listeners, I'm sure, as a Conservative member of the House of Lords, the former chief Brexit negotiator under Boris Johnson's government, and as I found out a couple of days ago, a fan of this podcast. So we're particularly delighted to have
and
you today.
And a peer of the realm.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
David, we're going to talk about a bunch of issues today because one of the reasons that we were really excited to talk to you was because, unlike many politicians these days, you do have a very strong commitment to freedom. Talk a lot about the issues that we talk about on this podcast in terms of the rights of people to do what they like, say what they like, and so on. But I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the kind of immediate small p political situation that you and your party find yourselves in. So we're coming off the back of another drubbing in the local elections. There's also been a defection today from the Conservatives to Labour, Natalie Elphick. Not a towering figure by anyone's estimation, I dare say, but at the same time, another kind of sign that the wheels are starting to fall off, it feels like. What's your take on where the Conservative Party are at? Because I saw a few weeks ago that you'd said something to the effect of You refuse to believe that it can't be turned around. Are you still in that position at this point?
I mean, as a theoretical proposition, I would say it's still possible to turn it around. Do I think it's at all likely? No, not really. I think the real problem that we've got as a party is just that, you know, 2/3 of the people who voted for us in 2019 no longer want to vote for us. They're sitting on their hands. Maybe some will come back. Probably most are not going to. And therefore, you know, unless we can have some policies that bring them back, then we're going to be in this situation when the election's called and we're going to lose. So, you know, the politics says, okay, what is going to bring back Conservatives to the party? And I say that's Conservative policies that we're not offering them. We still could. But mm-hmm. I don't think the party in Parliament really wants to do it. His heart's not in a shift to the right overall. And so we're probably just going to stay where we are and lose.
And in a nutshell, what do you think that Conservative offer should be? Like, if you were to kind of press the reset button right now and think, let's turn this around, what would be your, as I say, sort of nutshell as to how they could right the ship in that sense?
So I wrote a long piece in the Telegraph a couple of weeks ago on this and said, you know, we need to think about four freedoms. The freedom to govern yourselves as a country, the freedom to kind of transmit, as I call it, to inherit, to create, to own, to hand on, that sort of thing. Free economy, economic freedom, and freedom of speech. And I think those are the four things. There's obviously a lot that could be said within each of those, but there's a common thread, which is that the state is too powerful. We all look to the state to do too many things, and that's true of all parties, and we need to reverse that process. Mm-hmm. So that's where I would start. I think there's a kind of too much of a kind of pick and mix approach to politics. You know, what do the opinion polls say? What will satisfy people this day? And what we're finding is it doesn't work. You know, simply cutting taxes by a couple of percent, simply cutting national insurance, it doesn't work. It doesn't have the political effect unless people can see it's connected to an actual philosophy and where you want to take the country and why it makes sense. So you've got to start with the principles mm-hmm. and then you do the policies. But of course, it's just too late to do any of these things now.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it's too late to change leader as well?
I mean, it's, I look at it the other way around, I suppose, that it's, you've got to get the policies right and the approach right, and then you've got to have a leadership that is willing to do that. And if you short circuit the first bit of that and just focus all the time on who is the right leader, then you won't solve the problem. So it's not that it's not important, it's just it's not the first step. Mm-hmm. It's not the fundamental cause of the Conservative Party's problems at the moment.
Definitely. And to sort of pivot towards some of the issues very much in our wheelhouse over here at the Last Orders podcast, what message do you think it sends that it was the Conservative Party that introduced something like the generational smoking ban? Do you think that's, what does that represent, do you think, like, in terms of what the party now stands for, I guess?
It to me, it represents a party that's just lost its way completely, to be honest, both in philosophical terms, because, you know, if you accept the premise that any activity that can have a public finance cost to the government in the health service, for example, in this case, only exists because the government allows it. If you accept that premise, there's nowhere to stop. Mm. And that's not a Conservative premise. And that's the first problem. I think the second is it's just, you know, it's not in anyone's top 100 list of problems facing the country. It just isn't important enough for us to be spending legislative time on it. And I don't know why we're doing it. Mm-hmm. To me, it just shows that the Conservative Party has, to a very large extent, not entirely, there are still lots of good Conservative MPs and peers in Parliament, and the party in the country is still extremely Conservative, in my view. But it's just... It's accommodated itself to the zeitgeist, and all it is doing is sometimes trying to slow the pace, but it doesn't put up any philosophical challenge to it, and that's what we need to change. People have a right, I think, voters have a right to a party that offers a choice about mm-hmm. things. And at the moment, there's no one to vote for who will stop doing this nannying, controlling policy approach. There's nowhere to go.
And Chris, to bring you in here, feel free to respond to anything that David said there. But also, you wrote something this week for The Critic about the kind of petty prohibitionism of this government, but how it kind of goes far beyond what people even might associate with. People know about the smoking ban, but there's just been this kind of cascade of restrictions in recent years. Do you want to talk a little bit about that as it relates to what we're talking about
here? Yeah, sure. Because I think the tobacco and vape bill is kind of part of it. They are mostly bans. They're not all bans. The point is that they're all kind of luxury policies at best. You know, it's what I call displacement politics. You look at the last 10 years in particular, and, you know, you had 3.5 years of Brexit turmoil, followed by COVID almost immediately, followed by inflation, followed by a war in Europe, numerous prime ministers coming in and out. And yet, politicians, the political class, have still found an enormous amount of time for doing what seemed to me incredibly trivial things. I mean, the example I start off with in the article isn't something that ever became legislation because it was considered too culturally sensitive, but it was banning the possession of dog meat. The sale of dog meat already has been banned for many years, apparently. But
even if you've got some on you.
Some MP was worried there was a loophole that you could eat your own dog if it had been humanely destroyed. And no one had ever done this, as far as we know, nor wanted to. But Michael Gove, it's always Michael Gove, got involved and apparently started drawing up some legislation. It's just one example of very many, usually involving bans. And I think it's just an attempt to distract themselves as much as anything else. It really is.
Just to pass the time.
Just to stay busy. You know, look, we're doing things. You know, Parliament is busy at the moment. There's a lot of people on the right who think that the Tories should bring in a sort of right-wing version of the Equality Act to kind of tie the Labour government's hands. And maybe they could put together some act that kind of enshrined free speech or had some kind of, you know, recognition of gender reality in there, something like that. That hasn't happened, partly because I don't think actually most Tories even want to do that, because they are on the same page as Labour, which is why you can keep seeing these defections from Tory to Labour seamlessly, you know, from supposedly the opposite ends of the political spectrum. This is not people going to the Lib Dems as some sort of halfway house. Yeah. People directly switching from the Conservatives to supposedly their ideological opponents overnight, you know, and the Labour are quite happy to have them in with them. So, yeah, I mean, 14 wasted years, I think everyone would have to say, whatever your political disposition. I would be very interested to get back to the original question, I would be very interested to know actually why 2019 Conservative voters are now voting Labour. I can imagine all sorts of reasons and I can fully understand all sorts of reasons, but I would like to know what specific reasons they have, because it seems to me a lot of the major gripes that the public have with the government are things that the Labour would at least do as much of, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're against the huge immigration and indeed illegal immigration, I don't see any sign whatsoever that Labour are going to do anything about it. Do people actually think Labour are going to reduce that more than the Tories? Maybe they do. I'm not sure they do. Do they think that they would handle the economy better? Possibly. Do they think they handle the NHS better? Maybe a little bit, but they're probably going to get a shock because there isn't any more money to keep pumping into the NHS. So I'm genuinely interested what reasons people have, particularly if David's analysis is right and the Tories should actually tack to the right. What reasons they have for voting Labour? I think it probably is just the fact that Rishi Sunak is not... For whatever reason, he has not really grabbed the attention and affection of the British public. Mm-hmm. And I think after 14 years, you just get to the point where, well, let's kick the bums out and give the other guys a chance. But I didn't, even in the council drubbing, I didn't see a huge amount of enthusiasm for Labour.
No.
That didn't look to me, and I'm not a political analyst by any means, but it didn't seem to me like they were going to win the biggest majority ever from that.
And I suppose that's the caveat to what you're saying, is that a lot of these people aren't necessarily switching to the Labour Party. They're just not voting. I mean, some of the turnout in the by-election was incredibly low.
Labour got fewer votes than they did
last time, when they lost. But David, what's your read on that? Why do you think voters are, if not enthusiastically turning to the Labour Party, but certainly some of those voters are going back in the opposite direction after 2019?
Yeah, I think most of them aren't. I think that's the answer. If you look at, you know, the two-thirds who did vote and now won't, only about 15 to 20% of them are going to Labour and about the same to Reform. The middle 60, 70% are just saying they won't vote. They're not planning to come to the polls, or they don't know. And I think that because the existence of all those don't knows exaggerates the Labour lead, because they're eliminated from the polls, so it looks bigger than it.
Because most of them will vote, won't they? Election turnout doesn't change that much over the years.
Some will drift back, I have no doubt about that. A lot of them say they won't. Let's see when it comes to. But I think the answer is, I mean, part of the answer is that there's a kind of mythology about the Red Wall 2019 victory, which is that we got lots of Labour voters who wanted Labour policies, and that's kind of what led to levelling up and all that afterwards. Whereas in fact what happened was we broke the psychological hold of Labour in many areas over people who were really conservatives, you know, in their lifestyle, their aspirations, things they wanted to do. Mm-hmm. They were Tories, but they just couldn't bring themselves to vote Tory, and Brexit and Boris kind of broke that. And so I think we failed them by not giving them the sort of conservatism that they wanted. And I don't see it as, like, right. I mean, right in political terms. We use the shorthand shift to the right, because that's the code that enables people to understand. But these, you know, until very recently, the sort of things I talk about are just, like, normal mainstream conservative policies. It's only in the last 10, 15 years they've come to be seen, like, out there and away from the current opinion.
And Chris there mentioned equalities legislation, which kind of taps into this whole argument about the Tories and the culture war. Do you think there's any kind of stomach to do anything on the equalities front before the election? It seems like a very obvious trap to lay for Keir Starmer, you know, force him to repeal these policies, which would be seemingly overwhelmingly popular. Do you think there's any appetite for that in the party at the moment, or are they just all kind of switched off and waiting for the inevitable right now?
I mean, there's a kind of theoretical appetite. I don't think there's any real political appetite to junk something and find space to do these things. And there is a real problem, which is that it's not obvious that we've got a majority on these questions. The majority has fallen anyway, obviously quite a lot since 2019. You know, unless you went for an extremely targeted amendment on a, you know, deeply, deeply unpopular issue, it's not obvious we could get this through the Commons at the moment, because obviously all the opposition parties would vote against it, and I wouldn't guarantee that everybody in our party would support it, unfortunately. Mm. And I think that's also part of the problem.
But what do you make of this kind of dismissal of those issues as well? Because one of the irritating parts of the narrative at the moment is the Tories have spent all this time culture warring, and it's got them nowhere, because people don't really care about these issues after all. It's only really bread and butter, et cetera, et cetera. What do you make of that deflection whenever Tories raise some of these issues around gender, free speech or what have you?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a bit of what people used to say about Europe before the Brexit referendum, because, you know, you'd poll people on issues and Europe would come like about 10th or 12th. And people would say, well, they were concerned about the economy, they were concerned about the this, that and the other, all of which were highly connected, in fact, to the rules that came from Europe. It's just they didn't see it like that. And I think it's a bit the same for culture wars. You know, people maybe, you know, the polling response to some of these issues doesn't put it at the top, but there's definitely a sort of rebellion against the whole way of thinking that produces these policies. And that's what people feel unhappy about. That's the sort of change they wanted to see, I think, and we're just not delivering it. So the culture war is there. It's just the culture war exists because of the way of thinking of the metropolitan progressive elite that's governed the country for such a long time. And when you try and draw a line in the sand and say, no, we don't want some of these things, then it's culture war.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that a lot of the people who voted Tory in 2019 purely because of Brexit, or mainly because of Brexit, feel let down? That in some way they thought it was going to be a sort of a parting of the skies and things would just magically overnight get better, and that the Tories have therefore betrayed Brexit because things didn't get better?
I mean, there's an element of that.
Do you think the Tories betrayed Brexit, I suppose, is the other question?
No, I think, I mean, I always say, I give us 8 out of 10 for the Brexit we got, the main sort of loose end being Northern Ireland.
For the deal, yeah. Then what you do after?
What we did afterwards, obviously. I mean, I do think, you know, I've been as critical as anybody on all this, but I do think, obviously, the disastrous way we reacted to the pandemic you know, was a massive, massive distraction to developing sort of momentum that I think would have been there without that, and then the Ukraine war and so on. But, you know, we haven't, there wasn't a will to challenge migration, high levels of migration. There hasn't been a will to challenge net zero. You know, there hasn't been, we did put forward a proposal to reform planning, and it was spiked by, you know, sort of Tory MPs as well as many others. So yeah, we were still captured by the direction of travel and didn't challenge it enough.
And I'm glad you brought up Brexit, because that is obviously a key issue here. But just before we go back into the nanny state stuff, David, I was just wondering, what direction, you know, how confident are you that particularly after the next election, that the Tory party can kind of find itself again or work out what it's for? Because one thing that's been really striking at the moment is it's not as if the Tory, it's not just the fact that the Tory party has drifted too much to the kind of technocratic centre. It's not just the fact that the party is kind of out of touch with its voters. It doesn't really know what it's supposed to be arguing for at all. Mm. So it, therefore, it just reflects the other side. When, do you think there'll be, do you have any hope that there'll be like a proper debate now about what your political party is supposed to be for and what it's supposed to achieve?
I mean, I hope so. I mean, it's become so broad a church. It's like there's no opinion you couldn't find some Conservative MP that's force. You know, our council candidate in North Yorkshire arguing for nationalisation of the hotel. You know, it's just like, it's just become absurd. There has to be a kind of narrowing down of this. I hope we have that debate. Of course, for a long time, and I think a lot of people in the party have not internalised this, for you know, some years, if we lose badly, nobody's going to care what's going on in the Conservative Party. Mm-hmm. And it will be like a sort of sect arguing amongst itself if we're not careful. Mm. We do need to, you know, try and resolve this fairly quickly after an election. And we need that debate. What is conservatism? And actually, I think it will be debate on the right. Mm-hmm. The Reform Party, you know, the sort of disaffected people who don't want to vote for anyone. Everyone's going to be brought in to the debate. Mm-hmm. About what is right-wing politics in Britain after this defeat, this disaster? That's
and I think it's very important the Tory party gets that right for the country, because my prediction would be, and my political predictions can be taken with a pinch of salt, as long-time listeners probably know, but my prediction would be the Labour Party will be quite unpopular within about 18 months. Like I said before, I don't see a great deal of enthusiasm for Starmer and his would-be ministers. I think that the things that people are unhappy with are not going to be solved by Labour. They haven't got the money to spend in the way that Tony Blair did. They're not going to get grip on issues like migration, I don't think. So I think there's going to be quite a lot of rage out there, and then frustration, because obviously you've just kicked one bunch of people out and you've got some others in who seem to be doing more or less the same kind of thing. Starmer may well chuck out a couple of mad left-wing policies as well to really annoy the middle ground. And then it's a case of, well, where do we turn now? And, I mean, the obvious place to turn is to the Conservative Party. But people, I think, could start turning to more extreme parties if they... if they don't feel that the Tory party is giving them what they want. So I can see some years of frustration, anger building up over the next few years. Part of which, I have to say, is the electorate's fault for expecting too much and being unrealistic.
You always go back to this.
Well, yeah, because
the voters' fault.
I think that, yeah, it's not just in Britain this is happening. If you look across most of the Western world and beyond, actually, everywhere they've had inflation, which is basically every country that printed lots of money during COVID, their leaders have become incredibly unpopular very quickly at around the time when inflation was going at 10%. So you've seen Jacinda Ardern, who was incredibly popular, lose popularity. The AfD is rising in Germany as the ruling party is falling down. The Macron's getting less and less popular. It's happening everywhere. Biden was much more popular than Trump. People didn't give Trump a chance a couple of years ago. And so I think that people just blame the government for inflation. Which in a sense is correct, because the government kind of got the central banks to print lots of money so they could borrow it to give to people during COVID. But the people wanted that money. They were very happy with all the handouts at the time. It's just been such a long time since we had high inflation and high interest rates, high mortgage rates. 30 years, really. Most people have either forgotten what it was like or literally weren't around when it happened. Mm-hmm. And so they take it out on the government. Of course, that's probably going to start coming to an end soon. So I guess, you know, the parties that come in like Labour might be able to take some of the credit for it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, my fear is that, like I say, I think there's a lot of good reasons not to vote Conservative. But I suspect that a lot of people who are going to be turning against Conservatives are doing so because they believe that Liz Truss crashed the economy and the government spent £37 billion on an app.
Mm-hmm.
I want people to not vote Conservative for the right reason. You know?
I do think, I mean, in a way, the voters are never wrong. There's no point in kind of railing against the voters. Mm-hmm. That's democracy. The problem we've got, I think, is that... you know, Conservatives, Libertarians, small staters, whatever, call them what you will, have simply not explained how a modern economy works for the last 20, 25 years. All the pedagogical work that Thatcher and Major governments did has been forgotten. It's all got to be done again. And there's nobody in politics telling people, you know, you have to do certain things to get the economy growing again, and without a growing economy, you're not going to get any of these other things. And that involves a set of trade-offs, some of which you don't necessarily want. But unfortunately, that's what's got to happen. And we've got to begin this process of explaining why we're in this mess, and as a prelude to digging out of it. And if no politician does that, you can't blame voters for voting what looks like the easiest way out.
You're right there. I mean, in the 80s, I think the government, and Margaret Thatcher in particular, would go on TV and try and explain these issues of, you know, M3 money and inflation and interest rates, and this is what we're doing, this is why we need to do it. And there was just an understanding that if you want to tackle inflation, you had to control the money supply and put up interest rates. And because we haven't had inflation high for so long, people don't know that. You know, we live in a country in which the BBC feels obliged to tell readers and listeners and viewers every time inflation goes down that doesn't mean prices are going down. You know, now maybe we're not that dumb and we don't actually need that, and it's BBC being patronizing, but probably there's a reason they do that. People haven't got a clue. So I'm quite happy to blame the electorate. I'm not a politician, so I can say what I like about the electorate.
I just think the media and politicians often show themselves to be as ignorant of these issues as anyone else.
Yes, yeah.
So, well, you know, the quality of our public debate is pretty dreadful, and there's a lot of blame
that's true.
But we should move on, Chris, before we get to the postbag section, talk about some of the latest developments on the nanny state front, on the tobacco and vapes bill. I know you've been writing about this in the past few days. You want to tell us where that horrendous piece of legislation is at? I believe it's kind of in committee at the moment,
presumably.
It's
committee stage now. And look, whatever you think of the tobacco and vapes bill, listeners, and you'd be mad not to be against it, but whatever you think of it, this is really not the way to make legislation. Just objectively, this is not how law should be made. The impact assessment was a complete joke. This insane projections go into the end of the century about the smoking rate, which goes down and then suddenly stops going down for the last 50 years for reasons completely... mystifying, but basically so they can justify this ban on people born after the age of 2000, after the year of 2008 ever buying tobacco. So the impact assessment was laughable. The legislation itself is fairly preposterous insofar as all the vape stuff in it, and it's a tobacco and vapes bill, is just a pig and a poke. There's no policies there at all. The government hasn't finished its consultation on the vapes part of it. It just says the Secretary of State for Health will be able to do whatever they want with this, you know, packaging, flavours and so on. So the government essentially is, Tory MPs are voting, not in such large numbers, I'm pleased to say, but so far they are voting for legislation that essentially just allows Wes Streeting to do whatever the hell he wants with e-cigarettes as soon as he becomes health secretary, because the Tory party has not yet...
And he's a proper anti-vaping lunatic.
He says he will come down like a ton of bricks on the vaping industry, And then, we'll skip over the debate in the House of Commons, which was nauseating, and get onto the committee, because we're at the committee stage now. 18 MPs on the committee, 17 of them voted for the bill. Bearing in mind there was about 170 didn't vote for the bill, you think they might be able to find one or two who at least abstained. But no, they got 17 voted for the bill. One of them didn't, but she is the vice chair of the smoking APPG. So I can only assume she wasn't in London that day. She certainly is in favour of it. So everyone on the committee is in favour of it. And then you look at the list of people who've been invited to give evidence to it. I predicted it would be the usual suspects, of, Deborah Arnott from Ash and so on. But the actual list... blew even my mind. There were about 20 people. Some of them were unbelievably obscure. Some PhD researcher was on the list just because she started a campaign to ban disposable vapes, a complete non-entity. And then numerous people from either kind of state-funded charities like ASH or just the third sector blob or academics who are fanatically anti-nicotine, let alone anti-smoking. And they all came up and almost without exception paid homage to this piece of legislation, to what a wonderful piece of legislation it mm-hmm. was, how, you know, you know, the best thing this government's ever done, can't go wrong, we've been waiting for this for forever, blah, 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 one after another, 20, 30 different people. Now, if it is the case that all these people have been wanting this all this time, Chris Whitty thinks it's the best thing since sliced mm-hmm. bread, and so do all the other chief medical officers, why did they never mention it until now? Why is it? I've been on the radio and TV for donkey's years talking about these issues, and sometimes I will accuse these people of being prohibitionists and wanting to ban tobacco, mm-hmm. and they swear on a stack of Bibles every single time, no, that's just hyperbole, it's scaremongering, it's hysteria, it's libertarian slippery slope fallacy and all this. They absolutely swore blind. This was whatever they were lobbying for at the time, plain packaging, whatever it may be. No, this is about protecting children from the tobacco industry. And now they are to a man in favour of actual prohibition. And we've been lied to, haven't we, apart from anything else? These mm-hmm. are mendacious charlatans have been lying to us the whole time. And maybe we should consider that the same people who say similar things about gambling and alcohol and ultra-processed food, when you accuse them of being prohibitionists, perhaps they're lying too. Perhaps they're only waiting until they have sufficient strength to do what they would really like to do, and then they will do it. And I think they will.
And I mean, that points to one thing we've talked about a fair few times, which is the lack of pushback to this sort of stuff, David, in terms of prohibition on tobacco, vapes and so on. It just happens. It seems like most of the political class are really excited about it. And to the extent that there's a debate about it, it's really just one side doing a victory lap while some people yeah. nod to concerns about the black market or something. Have you been surprised by how uncontroversial this particular piece of legislation has been?
Not surprised, not really, mm-hmm. no, because it's just the way things are. It drives me mad, I must say, this thing. Somebody tweeted, I forget whether it was a Tory peer or MP, while this was going through the Commons, saying this is a conservative policy, it's thoroughly conservative, mm. it's about protecting people, you know, the usual line. And I tweeted that nobody thought this was a conservative policy until Rishi Sunak thought it up.
Yeah.
There was no demand for it. Nobody would have imagined that this was part of yeah. philosophical conservatism. Mm-hmm. But now, all of a sudden, it is. And it's like it always was. Nobody is pushing back. You know, we always were at war with East Asia or whatever. It's always been like this. Conservative philosophy has expanded to encompass this. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens all the time. You've written, I think, Chris, about the Lords Committee on Ultra-Processed Food, which is another example yes. of pact with people who absolute just have one opinion, you know, will not take evidence from anybody who challenges it. And it's just the way things are. I have to get this in, that the bit of business the Lords is doing on Friday is the pet abduction bill.
Oh, there's a lot of
which is
finally
inducing, you know, a cat to follow you down the street. Right. It's finally going to be against the law.
Absolutely, it's just incredible. I mean, the government is backing this bill. It has this weird exemption that it's an offence to induce a dog or cat to go with you, unless a couple had a dog, they split up, one of them gets it. Then if the other induces it to go with them, apparently that's not an offence.
They thought, I don't know, all out, haven't they?
What particular social evil that's designed.
See, this is what I mean. But we haven't built a nuclear power station since yeah. 1995, haven't built a reservoir since 1991, yeah. but we're having very detailed legislation in the dying months yeah. of a Conservative government. I think, well, what do we really need to do before we get kicked out? We might never be in power again. We've got to ban people from inducing cats down the street.
Yeah.
That's the priority. Yeah. This is, by the way, Neil O'Brien speaking barely a year ago. He was a public health minister at the time, saying this is at the Policy Exchange, actually. Mm-hmm. He was basically announcing the government's new tobacco control policy, which at the time was to dish out a load of free vapes to low-income smokers. And he says, directly referencing this generational ban idea, which at the time was just in a report by Javid Khan, which the government had more or less ignored. He said, now, of course, some would go further to stop people to start smoking in the first place. The Kahn Review last year advocated the New Zealand approach, a full phase out of smoking, with the age of sale increasing over time to cover all adults. This would be a major departure from the policy pursued over recent decades, which has emphasised personal responsibility and health of people who want to quit. A year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now apparently not just him, but everybody thinks that this is an obviously good idea, and anybody who doesn't think so is clearly in the pay of the tobacco industry.
Yeah.
Which is another thing, by the way, about the awful decision-making on this. They excluded something like 900 submissions from the public consultation because supposedly they had some links to the tobacco industry. Now, there are not 900 tobacco industry front groups in this country, right? They were including everyone who, well, for example, they were including retailers.
Mm-hmm.
Who technically are part of the, you know,
yeah,
the chain. You know, they are, I guess, they make money out of selling tobacco. Yeah.
But not quite the same thing as you and your various nefarious colleagues at Tufton Street.
Indeed.
And what you get up to. Yeah.
Right, exactly. You know. And so they, yeah.
Be rude to lump you together.
So these poor retailers who are going to really bear the brunt of this when they're starting to having to ask people, oh, mate, are you actually 42? You look 40, you know,
yeah,
41 to me. They're ignored. Yeah. So the whole thing, it stinks to me of a lack of confidence apart from anything else. Wouldn't you, if you were so confident this was such an obviously good idea, get a few people like me along to these hearings?
Yeah, and humiliate you.
Just as a devil's advocate. Mm-hmm. Show all my arguments up to be wrong. Show my, you know, the evidence I present to be false. They haven't, not a single person has even been vaguely kind of wavering on this. I mean, everyone who they've got in has been a full-blown prohibitionist fanatic. And that suggests to me that Sunak, in particular, is not confident about having a serious debate about this.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially very important. Well, it is not potentially. It is an important issue and a major precedent.
Mm-hmm. And you two will have much more experience of this than I have, but it is striking that when you know a lot about a certain issue and you give evidence to or speak at one of these committees, the lack of understanding of even the basics is quite striking. So they'll be passionately in favour of this smoking prohibition, but won't really have thought about it for longer than 10 seconds and repeat kind of talking points that have been fed to them. It came out with the Cash Review as well. You had all these Labour MPs repeating smear claims against it, straight up misinformation about apparently how it fiddled the statistics and whatnot, and then having to apologise because they misled the House. It's present company excluded. The quality of the politicians we have these days seems quite shocking. But we should try and squeeze in some postbag questions.
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
So we've got here one from JJ Hall from Twitter/X, addressed to David. Do you feel that party politics has become obsessed with virtue signalling and how politicians are perceived, quote, on the world stage rather than the needs of the people they serve? This is definitely something you see a lot of these days. I mean, this smoking ban is world leading as well in the worst possible way. But is that something that you've noticed?
I mean, it's part of a general kind of dumbing down, I think, that, as we were saying earlier, there isn't space in the media to do what we've just done, which is kind of talk about things for a few minutes and try and tease out the pros and cons. So if there isn't space to do that, all you can do is produce sound bites or produce images or produce something that's trying to capture attention, and that's what you see. Mm-hmm. You know, it isn't about trying to solve actual problems. I'm generalizing, but that, mm-hmm, I think that's the reason you see a lot of this stuff. It's the only way of getting
another
some sort
here.
Of message.
The Conservatives under Sunak seem to stand for absolutely nothing other than perhaps more nanny state. Are you, that's you, David, as you are not a candidate, would you consider a new party, e.g. Dominic Cummings' talk of a new startup party? I don't expect you to announce your defection here. And
yeah.
Theoretically, you know.
I think the problem is that the Conservative Party occupies the ground, and it's been the most successful right-wing party anywhere, really, for 200 years. It's got an organisation.
Electorally, yeah.
And electorally. and it's got a...
Don't take that away from them.
Well, that's what they're conservative.
It's got a membership that is, mm-hmm, still pretty conservative in my experience, mm-hmm, when you go around the country and talk to them. And I don't think it makes sense to kind of suddenly decide that all that doesn't matter and it's better to invest in creating something entirely new. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it may be that the result is so, the electoral result is just like so damaging, so devastating, it creates a new landscape, in which case we're in a different world. But I think it's much better to focus on making the Conservative Party conservative again. Mm-hmm. And I really don't see why people like me ought to be driven out. Why is it always us that are told to go somewhere else when we think we stand for the traditions that have, you know, been pretty conservative for 100 years or so?
So before we let you go, there's also one last question we'd like to ask you, which is a question that we ask every guest, given that this is a pro-freedom, anti-ban podcast, which is, if you had to have one ban, what would it be? So kind of dictator for the day. And as we always say, the only caveats here is that it can't be anything too worthy. You can't be banning world hunger.
It must be petty.
Exactly. Something that just irks you. Chris is famously as wheelie suitcases, which he has a strange obsession with. But so what would your ban be, David, if you had to have one?
So I think Britain needs to bring back sumptuary laws. That's my laws on clothing. And one of the things that gets me down in the gloom of winter is that everybody in this country wears dark clothing. They wear dark coats and dark suits and everything like that. And it's not actually quite the case if you go elsewhere in Europe. And I think it should be illegal to wear a dark coat, dark clothing between October and April. It ought to be compulsory to wear a bright, cheery colour. Bring back some colour to Britain. I would also say, I mean, there's loads of areas where you can...
I'm wearing all black at the moment as well, so I feel very shot at with this.
No, blue, I admit, but I also
what
think...
What do you wear in the winter? What's your overcoat colour? Orange, isn't it? Doctor Who? Or
I don't necessarily have to observe by the rule of science.
Oh, really?
That's a kind of fundamental political hypocrisy.
Do as I say.
Absolutely.
Same old story.
So campaign for colour, that's what we need in this country.
I like it. Chris, David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.